Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us once again on Queensbury Rules Radio. I'm Patrick Connor from Queensbury Rules. On the line, we also have James Foley of Bad Left Hook. James, I am still devastated about Anderson Silva getting knocked out.
I am too, to be honest. That was kind of brutal. Yeah,
awesome
was
a little bit
at
brutal.
The same time.
Yeah, he did a little bit of a funky Colt Medina there.
Oh my God, that was just weird. I didn't expect
that.
That.
That was kind of the news of the weekend, at least in the
sports combat
world. Probably the biggest.
For sure.
Yeah, that was the biggest shakeup. But no, that's not what we're here to talk about today.
We can only hope
boxing.
That Floyd Mayweather befalls a similar fate in September.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of torn as to what exactly is going to happen or what's better for the sport. But it would kind of be nice to see, you know, somebody of a an elite caliber take over, and, you know, knocking out Floyd Mayweather would be a pretty huge blow.
Yeah. Yeah. And not to talk about the Silva thing too much, but that's kind of the part of the problem. You don't really want a scenario like that because there's still a large percentage of the people that are going to be just convinced that it was Silva, you know, his own undoing. I mean, if he hadn't clowned around like that and put himself in that position. So I don't think Weidman's getting as much credit as, you know, he would if it had been more of a kind of clean knockout. But, you know, things like that rarely happen in boxing, although, of course, we had the Nate Campbell thing a few years ago.
Yeah, that was, man, that was, and I'll preface this by saying that I was never a huge Nate Campbell fan, but that was tough to watch, dude. Like, that knockout and then the interview afterwards where they were interviewing him and he was, like, in tears, I was like, oh, dude, end it, come on. Don't do this. That was pretty rough. But, I mean, you know, Anderson Silva didn't exactly give the best post-fight interview himself, but...
No,
anyway,
no.
out of the world...
Best
of
post-fight
MMA,
interview, I think we all know where that what that was from this past weekend.
Yeah, we're pretty familiar with that, you know, guy just got knocked out getting interviewed type of stuff. So, you know, give it a good week and let the guy kind of get his laurels about him. But in the world of boxing, you know, I guess we were going to talk about basically David Price once again losing to Tony Thompson. But I wanted to kind of save that just a little bit for our man Corey Erdman, who's going to be joining us in just a little bit.
Just received a text. So Erdman had an important phone call at 4 o'clock, and now he's been delayed 15 minutes. So... you know, hopefully we'll have him on for 10 minutes at the end of the show.
No worries. Not a problem at all. But
we can talk some other stuff, too. I mean, there's plenty of other
stuff
to talk about.
There's plenty of other stuff to bullshit about in the world of boxing, as there always is. But I actually wanted to go over this last week's Friday night fights, if possible. Basically, the main event was Billy Dibb taking a decision over... what's his name? Mike Oliver, sorry. We talked about it last week, and I think that it wound up being a closer fight than a lot of us thought it would be, especially with a guy like Mike Oliver, who's not a big puncher, and, you know, Billy Dibb actually has had a little bit of, you know, hype surrounding him. I think that he's fallen short of the hype for the most part, but still, we expected him to win fairly handily when we talked about it last week, and that's not exactly what happened. It was a pretty close fight. How did you wind up scoring that fight, or what did you see in it?
I thought Dibb probably won a close decision. I wasn't really scoring it that, you know, intently. But, you know, these are the kind of fights that it's just really hard for me to get interested in to actually sit there and watch it. You know, I wasn't doing anything on Friday night, so I watched the whole broadcast, just kind of have something on in the background. But... You know, a fight like this is tough because it's like, you know, do you see Dibb being competitive with the best guys in that division, the guys like Mikey Garcia and Abner Mares? No. You know, you see him struggling with these kind of close fights against fighters who just seem to be beneath that level themselves. Now, I'll have some interest in watching his rematch with Gradovich, because I thought the first fight was pretty good. But, you know, a fight like this against a guy like Mike Oliver, it was a lot closer than we kind of thought it would be, and maybe again it kind of signals that Dibs maybe declining a little bit physically. But, you know, it's just one of those fights I don't really see that, you know, what it leads to. It's almost a tune-up fight for Dibs to just go into the Gradovich rematch. And I know it wasn't originally meant to be the Friday night fight's main event, but, you know, this is just a tough fight for me to really get excited about.
Yeah, I was actually gonna chime in and say, in all fairness, the Friday night fights, that wasn't their intended main event. And I could imagine that, you know, having that as kind of a co-main event probably would have been, you know, a little bit more satisfying with who was supposed to be on the main event, which was Alan Green versus, oh my gosh, we talked about it last week, and Alan Green wound up missing weight, basically, but it was supposed to be Alan Green versus Eliezer Alvarez. And Alan Green missed weight by, what was it, like 9 pounds or something like that?
it wasn't close.
Yeah, it wasn't even remotely close.
But the fight was still going to go on.
Yeah, and
right.
it was just... Well, I don't know
then
what the
initial... Then he got food poisoning from Chinese food.
Yeah, I don't know what the initial agreement was, but it sounded like they were going to go through with the fight, and then Alan Green came forth and said that he had gotten food poisoning from something like Chinese food or whatever. So,
I mean, it just sounds like, who knows? It doesn't sound good.
Well,
you know, I mean, a guy
misses
Alan weight
Green
by 7 pounds, and then the fight supposedly it's going to happen, and then he said, oh, now I have food poisoning. I mean, I'm curious to know kind of the details, but I am not really that curious because it's, you know, Alan Green we're talking about. So... Go ahead.
Well, he had so much behind him after he had knocked out Jadon Codrington quickly.
Yeah.
And then I remember when he had that shitty performance against Edson Miranda, his excuse was that he had stomach cramps or he had the stomach flu or something like that after that. So, I mean, you know, he's kind of creeping into that, you know, Yoan Guzman territory where you're starting to just not even really give a shit what he is in the ring, but you just don't even really want to deal with it, whatever it is.
Yeah, and I had some, like, mild intrigue going into this fight, but it just sounds like he didn't want to fight. You know, I mean, cry foul on his official story, but it just doesn't sound like, I mean, it just doesn't sound good. And why would, you know, it just the Chinese food seems, I mean, I'm curious, like, when he ate this Chinese food. It seems like an odd choice, like, immediately after the weigh-in. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. Like most guys,
not like
go
he was
over
in like Chinatown in San Francisco, or he was at, you know, where was this fight at?
You know, I don't know. Maybe
resort
he went back to his room. We got some takeout.
Panda Express.
Yeah, I mean, I had a little bit of a poo-poo platter joke whipped up there, but I didn't know if that was going to fly. But you know, as far as Billy Dib goes, you know, I wasn't all that impressed, and you said you didn't watch it super closely, but in the first couple rounds, Mike Oliver got hit with a few low blows, and he went down, and the fight got kind of, like, delayed for a couple minutes.
That's right. Yeah. It looked like, I mean, the referee said one more low blow, and he's going to stop it.
Yeah, I thought that the warning to stop it was a little bit excessive, because a couple of the blows were somewhat borderline, but there were one or two that were, like, fairly low. And so on Twitter, I remember I was kind of like, you know, of course, reading along my Twitter timeline as I'm watching. And a bunch of people are like, oh, my God, Mike Oliver, what a bitch. He's faking it, blah, blah, blah. And I was just kind of like, I don't know. I mean,
boxing fans always
wearing...
a compassionate crowd, right?
Yeah, I know. I mean, there are times when a guy gets hit and it's, like, clearly, you know, on his, like, belly button because his trunks are high and he goes down like he just got shot. You know, that's a little bit different. But or Bernard Hopkins taking a tap to the shorts and then going down like somebody, you know, sliced him with a hatchet. But, you know, I don't know. To me, they were fairly hard punches. They looked kind of low, whatever. Anyway, Billy did wound up, you know, winning anyway, so it didn't really matter. But on the undercard, they put forth they kind of tried to build some hype on the, I guess it wound up being the co-main event, the kind of makeshift co-main event for Friday Night Fights. They tried to build some hype from some weigh-in, you know, almost scuffles and stuff like that between Mark Too Sharp Davis and Robert Osiobe. I'm not sure exactly how they were pronouncing that, but I don't know. It wound up being an okay fight, but, you know, considering what we, I guess, should have gotten, it was, whatever. It was Friday Night Fights.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I mean,
for
me, Friday Night Fights is more of just like ambiance to have on in the background most of the time. And if something turns into a good fight, it's exciting. I guess it's nice to see some prospects who really have a chance of, you know, moving up. Like, I mean, guys like Arizlani Lara were on there. Javier Fortuna seems like he's got a bright future. But, you know, a lot of times it's just not. That's just not the case.
Well, it seems to me like the late season shows, like fairly late season shows of Friday Night Fights, wind up being better than the early season shows. You know, at least from what I've noticed in the last few years. So hopefully that
means
that we're given, you know, a little bit better.
You know, they have this big one coming up in Chicago in August with Andre Fonfara against Gabe Campillo. And then they've got the Spilka Malo, too, that heavyweight brawl from earlier this year rematch.
Yep.
So, you know, it's not a great quality of fights, but, I mean, it could be entertaining. And I don't know if you've seen Fonfara much.
Stuff like that with a good, you know, a good regional draw, you know, that makes sense too. And it's
a lot of those
cards seem to have more lively crowds.
Well, I had a lot of doubts because it's at U.S. Cellular Field where the White Sox play, which I think seats 40,000 people. And I think they have it sectioned off, so it's going to have a max at about 15. And they're probably not going to do anything close to that. But so I had some doubts about that venue because it just seems kind of an ambitious scheme just to have, you know, Andre Fonfara headlining it. But, I mean, it's probably will be the best crowd of the entire season on Friday Night Fights because you're going to, you know, that guy pulls 5,000 people to most of his fights at UIC Pavilion, which is like a smaller inside kind of basketball arena. And I think with it being – and I know some non-boxing fans who are just interested in it, you know, the fact that it's at a baseball stadium and it's outside and, you know, that – I think could actually get a pretty good crowd. And the Polish fans here are just crazy. I mean, they're raucous and they support their guys. And, you know, I've been to a couple Fonfara fights and, you know, he's a good fighter. I mean, it's hard to imagine that he's going to be a real world-class top 10 guy, but, you know, personally, I mean, I was at the Glenn Johnson fight. I thought he beat Glenn Johnson pretty convincingly. There's some people on Twitter who I think saw it the other way, but, you know, so yeah, it's definitely good. I mean, what those promoters are doing here is really good with considering the talent that they have to work with.
No, I agree, and I mean, I know that I'm not sure about the last 2 years because I think that I have seen reports that ESPN had given the Friday Night Fights crew or show a little bit more money to work with in the last few years, but I know that in previous years they kept reducing it. So I mean, even so, even if they have gotten an increase in the last few years, or even if they haven't, regardless, I know that it's not a lot of money to work with in order to pay, you know, main event type of fighters
and then
get decent fights on the undercard.
It's
a pretty significant gap
between even, you know, an ESPN headline compared to like a Showtime undercard fight. I mean, I think those guys are making two or three times as much as the headliners on probably the most expensive Friday Night Fights. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, being from Chicago and everything, I should also mention, you know, I think that it proves that Chicago can be a great fight town when you get a guy, you know, Fonfara is drawing 5,000 people, and some of these fights we see on HBO with guys who, like Tim Bradley on his way up or Andre Berto on his way up, and they're million-dollar purses, you know, getting 2,000 people at these venues that don't even make sense, like geographically. And, you know, I didn't go to it, but that Mayweather-Canelo press conference here, I mean, there was like 4,000 people showed up like hours in advance to wait in line to go into a free theater. I mean, you could have showed up, you know, at like when the doors opened and walked right in, but 4,000 people showed up on the street or something like that waiting for hours in advance just to see Mayweather and Canelo, you know, do their pre-rehearsed lines for 10 minutes. So, I mean, I look at cities like this with this great, like, ethnic diversity, and there's no doubt in my mind. I mean, if Canelo Alvarez headlined a card here, he could do 15,000 people easily. You know,
oh, yeah,
and you put it at Wrigley Field or something like that, it's huge. So I wonder,
yeah,
you know,
I
know there's tax reasons and other, like, financial benefits of doing fights at casinos and doing them in Nevada and things like that. But, you know, you have a lot of great cities around the country that you know, would be, I think, great setups for fighters who are, you know, only fighting in one or two places.
And I think overall it probably demonstrates a lack of, I guess, thinking outside the box or creativity for a lot of promoters and people who make fights. And the only reason I say that is because I think that there could be doing a lot more, especially with regional type of cards, you know, to make these events bigger than they are. And to touch on what you're saying about Chicago, I mean, what was it? Rocky Graziano versus Tony Zale was in the old Chicago stadium that they demolished in, I think, the 90s or something like that. So, I mean, and they used to have fights there all the time.
Yeah, there were huge fights in Chicago.
Well.
I think the long count, Dempsey Tunney, was at Soldier Field. And, like, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, Ray Robinson, Jake LaMotta, that fight was at Chicago Stadium. I mean, there were tons of big fights here. And really until the emergence of Las Vegas, I guess, in the 60s, and then maybe I'm sure there's some kind of, like, politics thing, you know, a lot of it just has to do with, like, tax breaks and what the state will offer you to bring in events like that. But yeah, boxing really stopped here, those kind of events, sometime around, like, the 1950s, 1960s. And I don't think there's been a big, I mean, the only things I can remember here recent that were, you know, any kind of notoriety, I think it was Paul Malignaggi against Juan Diaz, the rematch. Was in Chicago, the suburbs here, for some reason. You know, that doesn't make, like, no sense. So, I mean, there's plenty of, you know, the thing about Chicago, it's top three in the country in Mexican population and Puerto Rican population. Pretty big fight fans. And it just seems like you bring a draw here, you know, you get good results, but it just really hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess it's, okay. I'm sure that the mob influence and stuff like that had something to do with, you know, the popularity of boxing in those times. So, you know, as soon as the mob started to decline a little bit, that's kind of right around when it seemed boxing started to decline in Chicago. But even just in terms of playing up the ethnic thing in Chicago, there's a lot of different angles to take. And I know the Chicago Golden Gloves used to be friggin' huge. Now
yeah.
I really have no idea because I don't follow amateur boxing. I would imagine so because, I mean, at its heart, boxing is really just a, you know, it's, I don't want to call it ethnic, but it's more of a class type of thing. And so, you know, it tends to be, I don't want to say pushed, but I guess, you know, suggested to or a little bit more accessible to people who aren't coming from money, who would, you know, choose other sports. So, I mean, yeah, I would hope,
I mean,
it's still huge.
Obviously, it would help to have a local guy from one of those demographics to, you know, really build upon. But, you know, you just look at what these guys have done with Fanfaro, with the Polish community, which is much smaller than, you know, like, the Mexican population here. I mean, much, much smaller, you know. And for them to get 5,000 fans to come to see this guy's fights on a Friday night, I mean, that's pretty impressive to me, considering that the guy, you know, I mean, even 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I mean, he just beat Glenn Johnson. He's still not really on, like, a world-class level yet. But even as just an up-and-coming prospect, he was getting big crowds.
Yeah,
and I think
for
it shows
sure.
you
I mean,
that, like, you know, you find a niche and you can market this to a certain group of people. And you know, I'd say probably like 90% of the crowd for the Fanfaro fights is Polish. But the other 10% is guaranteed to have a good time because you've got a really raucous, you know, crazy group of people screaming and yelling and waving flags and singing and all that stuff. And it just makes it a great atmosphere. And I'm sure the same could be done with tons of, you know, different, like, ethnic groups if you brought somebody in who people would rally behind.
Well, I think that there is a market, as you said, for those kind of like, I don't want to say small cards, but smaller cards where they're in the, like, you know, few thousands rather than in the, you know, whatever, tens of thousands.
Ten, yeah.
And I mean, the problem is that you get these kind of like HBO or Showtime main events. And then when you see the attendance of those type of fights, unless they're fairly large fights, they're usually in like the 5 to 10,000 range. So, I mean, to me, that says that, you know, I've heard a lot of different writers and different kind of pundits or whatever you want to call them talk about how ticket sales don't matter anymore, not like they used to, because now it's all about the TV rights and it's all about the pay-per-view sales and that's where they make the money, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure it is. However, at the end of the day, it's just really losing the connection with the boxing fan, because when people aren't able to go to fights that are, you know, at least somewhat cheap and aren't going to break your bank to be able to attend, and then, you know, it even looks more stupid when we have these kind of like, you know, 16,000, 17,000, 18,000 seat arenas, and then the attendance is like 4,700, and it's just like, what's the disconnect? What's going wrong here? You know, it's pretty crappy. And that kind of leads into, I guess what I wanted to get started talking about before it got to be too late, I guess, but, you mentioned it, Floyd Mayweather versus Canelo Alvarez. Now,
yeah.
What's kind of intriguing to me about this, aside from the fight, obviously, because I do think it's an intriguing fight. I think Floyd will win, but I think it's an intriguing fight. The way that it's being promoted and how it looks to me like it's going to be pretty huge. Like, what do you see this doing in terms of pay-per-view sales, at least from what you've seen so far?
I don't know. You know, I think you're right. I mean, I think they've done a great job promoting it. I think that city tour really raised a lot of awareness about it. And I was kind of going to draw on, like, your point, you know, like you said, 4,500 people show up in a 15,000 arena. I mean, you can't force people to be interested in things. You can't just force people to, like, go watch a fight. But, you know, I was here, you know, I was watching the news and stuff the night when the press conference was here, and there's 4,000 people lining up to go watch a press conference. So there's massive interest here, you know. I don't think it's going to get close to the 2.5 million that Floyd and Oscar did, but the way things are going and you know, looking at a fight like Mayweather Cotto, what did that do? 1.4, something like that? 1.5 maybe?
I want to say it did something like 1.3, 1.4.
Okay.
Either way, it did a lot.
You know, I think somewhere between 1.5 and 2 is pretty reasonable. You know, the high end, maybe 2 million. I mean, it's going to be a big fight. And I think as it gets closer, you know, a week or two out, you're just going to see the TV and everything just flooded with commercials and people doing interviews. And you know, I think this is going to do a lot better than any pay-per-view in recent years. I mean, definitely, I would say, feel pretty confident saying it'll be the biggest pay-per-view since Floyd and Oscar. I'd be pretty surprised if it came close to that number, you know, just because I think that I mean, Oscar was just a much bigger star than what Canelo is. Floyd wasn't quite, I mean, Floyd wasn't close to being the star that he is now, but he was still known as the best fighter in the whole sport. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe if you'd have to shift the roles, kind of compare Floyd now to Oscar then as the A-side and Canelo to Floyd back then. And I think one of the differences is that, like, back then, it was a pretty clear, like, the superstar of boxing versus the best fighter in boxing, or the best boxer. And I think that was an intriguing dynamic. This one's a little bit different. You know, Canelo doesn't have quite this, I mean, anywhere near really the pedigree that Floyd had going into that fight. But
for sure. And actually, you know, I think that Floyd did have some, he did have some drawing power going into that fight, and I think that he probably did his fair share to sell the fight. Personally, I also didn't think that fight was a 7-5 type of fight. You know, I see that getting brought up in arguments and saying, oh, well, Oscar kept it close with the jab and stuff like that, and I'm like, in my opinion, he really didn't, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting fight to look back and kind of analyze. You know, I thought Floyd certainly won it. I don't think that was even an argument. But at the same time, you know, he didn't blow him away. He didn't.
No, Oscar did take a couple of early rounds.
Right, but
he did take a couple early rounds.
Yeah, I mean, I think Oscar won some rounds, but you know, it was, I think, kind of classic Floyd at the time. I think it was genuinely, you know, even though Oscar was definitely past his best, I think it was a, you know, arguably the toughest challenge Floyd had ever fought in the ring, just based on size and the fact that Oscar's experience on that level, and the, you know, I think you could put that up there, right, kind of on that next tier behind like Castillo and Corrales and what he did, at, you know, at 130 and 35. So I think Floyd was very cautious in that fight at times. You know, he wasn't looking to, like, you know, really put on a show for the crowd, and that's not really what he does unless the opponent really just kind of bends over and lets him do it. You know, so he won the rounds, and he, you know, he racked up his points and he took the victory. But I mean, it's to me, that's nothing to, you know, really, like, Floyd didn't just destroy Oscar.
No,
Floyd easily won the fight, but he outboxed him for sure, but he didn't destroy him.
I remember it was either the fourth or fifth round, and there was a point at which, like, you know, through about like four rounds, I thought Oscar had taken like two or three because he was doing much better with his jab than I thought, and then he was actually kind of being a little bit of a bully in there and whatever. But then there was a point at which, like, Floyd just kind of started opening up, and when he did, he was hitting Oscar like really cleanly. And then I remember Floyd went back to the ropes, and Oscar kind of followed him but was a little bit hesitant, and Floyd just, like, cracked him with a left hook, but it was something like he cracked him with something and then scooted away, and Oscar, like, kind of almost stumbled into the ropes a little bit because he was like, oh, shit, he hits pretty hard.
Yeah, I think
Oscar suffered. And from then on, it looked a little bit different.
Well, I think he suffered kind of the same fate that a lot of Mayweather opponents do, which is just late in that fight, Mayweather had him completely figured out, and he had no idea how to adjust. You know, and then he just became tentative. And every time he had Floyd on the ropes, Floyd would just block and dodge all of his punches. And, you know, he got frustrated, and he definitely was kind of out of his depth by the end of it.
When you start getting hit, like, from angles that you just don't, like, really expect or know what to do with, and when you start getting hit when you're not expecting it and with shots that you just don't see coming, that is just so discouraging, or at least I'd have to imagine.
Yeah. And I think also when you're missing all your punches, you know, I think also when you miss so many punches against a guy and you know you're just not getting him clean, it's hard to keep motivating. You know, you know that the best strategy, you have to just keep doing it and just try to break through. But it's easier said than done. And I think a lot of guys start rethinking.
For sure.
And when you start kind of thinking in the ring, I mean, it's just, it never, that never works well.
That's the big holdup for me. That's exactly the big holdup for me in this fight is that, you know, I'd like to see Canelo come in and be really aggressive and kind of assert some dominance and, you know, play up his size a little bit against Floyd. But, you know, just the way that he seems to have been acting in his last few fights where he was, you know, aggressive, but also a lot of the times it was almost like after the Trout fight, a lot of people were saying, oh, did you see Canelo's new defense? It's so new and improved and magical and great. And I'm like, well, hold on there. You know, it's good. Don't get me wrong. And he's definitely improved. But if he starts trying that shit against Floyd, it's going to be all over, all of it. It's going to be over. That is not going to work against Floyd Mayweather for Canelo.
Yeah, and looking at Canelo, he's certainly been more aggressive when he's had opponents that I think he knows he can kind of dominate physically. And he's guys like Cintron and Lopez and even Mosley, to, you know, I think he, against Trout, you saw when he was kind of giving a guy more respect and being more cautious, you know, I think he landed a lot of great punches and I thought he won the fight. I'm not sure that that's the right approach with Floyd. I just, you know, it's, you know, either somebody's going to end up, you know, finding some way to be successful against Mayweather and winning the fight like that, or Mayweather at his age is just going to physically decline and somebody's going to take advantage of a diminished version. And that's the two ways that, you know, he could potentially lose. It's tough to look at Canelo now and think that against the, you know, the best version of Floyd, or even, you know, the version that just fought Guerrero, against the Floyd who's still kind of physically in his prime and quick enough to execute all of his maneuvers, it is hard to kind of see Canelo being able to win unless he can land some kind of a miracle punch and hurt Floyd and, you know, try to change things that way. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's more poetic, as Lampley would say. I think it's more poetic if Canelo beats him.
Probably, and it's probably the better. I mean, I'm kind of wrestling with what's better for boxing long term, but you know,
it's
probably better for Canelo to win for boxing long term, just because he's younger and there's more, you know, upside. I'm not so sure that Floyd's really going to have, like, what did he say? Like, he initially said he was going to have like 2 or 3 more fights, and then he said he was going to do 6 with this deal, and then a couple days ago or a week ago he said, why stop at 49-0? I'll keep going for years and years. And I'm like, something tells me that that's not really going to be Floyd. But I mean, regardless,
maybe one fight you could kind of make a parallel here would be De La Hoya against Whitaker. And Pernell was obviously, I think, a little bit further on the downside than Floyd is right now. But there's kind of some similarities there. At the same time, De La Hoya was, I would say, much more advanced than Canelo is now, too. And probably just maybe a better, more talented fighter, at least from what we know now. But, you know, I think that's maybe a possibility of kind of a fight like that, where Canelo can be more active, maybe make Floyd be a little bit more cautious, and you end up getting some kind of mixed scorecards that, you know, I think that's probably the best case I could see for Canelo. If he were to win, that it would be some kind of a controversial, really close fight that people would argue could go either way, and most of the kind of boxing purists will say that Floyd picked him apart. Oh, is Erdman around?
Yeah, I got it. Indeed. I'm going to patch him in right now.
Awesome.
Mr. Corey Erdman.
How are you guys? Sorry, I was just busy filing my latest. I had to get that in, you know?
All right. What is it, training camp report?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Awesome.
What's going on, fellas? It's a pleasure to be on here.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks so much for coming on. So
yeah,
we were just talking about.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Sorry. Well, we were talking about. Talking about Floyd Mayweather Canelo.
Yeah, I hear that fight's coming up. Yeah, that should be pretty interesting. What's the topic of discussion today?
James was actually just comparing it to De La Hoya Whitaker a little bit, in that one guy was the kind of former great, or, you know, potential maybe current great, and also the other guy has the upside coming up. So, I don't know. We were initially talking about how we thought that fight was going to go, but I had asked, you know, how big do you think that fight is going to be?
Well, I do think that it's set up to probably economically be either the first or second biggest fight of all time. I mean, I think everything that Floyd is doing at this point in his career is just kind of working toward press release material, because, you know, if anything he does has to make a really good headline and has to validate why Showtime gave him all that money to come over. So, you know, if he has the second highest grossing pay-per-view of all time, then you get the press release saying he has the top two or the top three or whatever. I think because they've bumped up the pay-per-view buys, someone's done their market research and has determined that, no, it's not going to get 2.4, but it could probably get somewhere around 1.6 or 1.7, and with the inflated price, might be able to break some economic numbers. I could see it landing in that range. I mean, I could see 1.6, 1.7 for this fight. I mean, they've just done so much more press for this fight, and they've been able to do so much more press. I mean, the failure of the Guerrero fight, I don't think it is on Floyd. It's on the fact that Robert Guerrero was utterly unpromotable, and he wasn't able to promote himself. And then even when they tried, he went out and got himself arrested. You know, and even the people that were supposed to like Robert Guerrero just found him a little bit irritating. He just didn't work. But Canelo is the exact opposite. He's so likable to so many people, and to a specific market, the Mexican-American market, that they couldn't nab with Robert Guerrero, that this could be the perfect storm to land in, you know, the top three of highest-grossing pay-per-views ever.
Wait, Corey, but what about Guerrero's appearance on the 700 Club?
I mean, that
surely that added like at least 100,000 buys.
What are the ratings for the 700 Club? I mean, how many people? I know Mario Serrano sent it out like it was a big deal, but how many people watch Pat Robertson Where You Are? I don't even know if we get it in Canada.
Yeah, there's like a Venn diagram with boxing fans and people who watch Pat Robertson. I think there's like one person in the middle.
Right. Yeah. and they were going to buy
like,
that pay per view anyway. So.
Yeah, it's like two circles that are barely touching. That's what the Venn diagram is for that one.
Yeah,
well,
you know,
other
than those shows, it was impossible to do anything with Robert. I mean, he was just bad television and bad radio.
Yeah, but he inspired the world. So
of course.
His post-fight comment. Or he would have if Jim Gray hadn't pulled the mic away from him.
Well, I'm actually glad you brought up the Guerrero thing because I actually have a question about that as well. Now, in the wake of the fight, there seemed to be kind of an argument or, you know, whatever, crapping on it, whatever you want to call it. But there seemed to be just kind of speculation that since the fight didn't seem to do that well, or at the very least not as well as they'd hoped, that Showtime would then urge Floyd to take the Canelo fight now as opposed to, you know, what was it, 5 fights in his deal and, you know, taking it in the 4th or 5th or something like that. Do you think that was the case?
I think it absolutely could have been the case. If it wasn't, I think there's and we all speculate about Floyd's ego and exactly what drives him to do what he does. So this is obviously complete speculation on my behalf as well. But if Floyd heard the numbers and wasn't impressed with them, then I think if Floyd behaves the way that we think he has or the way we think he does, the way we have him pegged, then he would look at those numbers and say, oh, man, I better really hit the next pay-per-view out of the park and go for Canelo. And, you know, maybe he just thinks that he can beat Canelo anyway. I mean, it may not matter to Floyd whatsoever, but I think that, yeah, if I'm Showtime and the numbers weren't particularly appealing to me, if we lost money or if my numbers people in Showtime looked at that and said, if we do 6 of these, we're getting no return on our gigantic investment, yeah, then I would strongly suggest to Floyd that you should fight Canelo. I think it's perfectly plausible that happened.
Corey, what do you think? Do you think Canelo has any real shot here to win the fight?
I don't. I think that, and I'm not going to use these intangibles and whatnot that most people use when they talk about boxing. He just doesn't have the experience. Well, I mean, there are lots of guys with little experience that just have the talent or have the particular skill set to win a given fight. I just don't think he has that. In the tangible departments, when you look at them standing face to face, when they both have the same sneakers on, he's not all that much bigger than Floyd. And I'm sure he's going to balloon to be heavier than Floyd, but he's not going to be much taller than him. And his arms aren't going to be that much longer than him. So it's still going to be a slightly heavier guy trying to catch up to this guy.
What about the thickness versus length argument?
Thickness versus if he hits Floyd.
I mean, he is thicker than Floyd. He's big. He's, you know, physically his body is just a little bit bigger.
Right. You know, but you still with
height,
your
you're
thickness,
right,
you still right with your thickness, you still have to cut off the ring. And I haven't found Canelo to be that effective of a pressure fighter in the past. I mean, he's fighting guys who have been so much smaller that he's just been able to track down. You know, I haven't ever looked at a Canelo fight and said, wow, he really cut off the ring well in that fight. And, you know, if he is good at it, he's going to have to prove it against the most evasive guys ever. And I just don't see him being able to catch up with Floyd. I see him getting hit with a lot of flush shots. I mean, really, in the Trout fight, that was the first time people perked up and said, hey, Canelo can defend himself a little bit. And if that's just a new revelation for a fighter one fight ago against a guy as accurate as Floyd, that's not saying too much. I can see him winning some rounds. I could maybe even see it being close on one scorecard if the rounds aren't particularly active, if Floyd – because I don't think Floyd's going to be chasing after Canelo. – I think he knows he's in there with, as you mentioned, a thicker guy who could potentially hurt him. So there will be some rounds where there won't be too much going on. So Canelo might be close on one of the scorecards, but I think it's still a different class for him with Floyd.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I noticed like in a few of the recent Floyd fights, he's actually been walking forward and not really fighting backward as much as he did kind of some at times during, against De La Hoya, against guys who've really come forward to him. It seemed like against like Mosley and Ortiz and even Guerrero, he pretty much stood his ground and did most of his defense with his arms and his shoulders and all that stuff. So I'm curious kind of, yeah, how this fight's going to unfold as far as like the movement of the ring. Is Canelo going to come forward? Canelo didn't really come forward against Trout either. He seemed like he
exactly,
was kind of
yeah.
fighting, backpedaling most of the time and letting Trout lead. So, I'm kind of very curious, like, who's going to take the initiative. It's hard to imagine they're going to fight it, just slug it out at center ring. So I think somebody's going to walk forward, and it's likely going to be Canelo. But I think Floyd does that to kind of put his opponents off guard. And his defense is so good, even without his legs, that, you know, he can get away with doing that. And it seems like it's disrupted some fighters.
Well, here's what's interesting to me is that people, whether I believe Canelo has a chance or not, people are believing that Canelo has a chance. And as a result, if you're a betting man, this is the narrowest line that you'll ever get Floyd Mayweather at in your life, at about minus 200 or minus 220 or whatever it's sitting at. This is, if you're a betting man, you have to bet on Floyd Mayweather. I mean, there's no value in betting on Canelo at this point because the monstrosity of an upset over Floyd Mayweather is so great that you better get paid out for that if you're going to bet against him. So it's interesting to see the betting lines lay where they are right now. We've never seen this with Floyd since De La Hoya.
Well, I think it's pretty interesting in the sense that, you know, they've a lot of people have been saying we just want a challenge. You know, we don't want somebody who's been recycled or somebody who blah blah blah. And to me, I don't really think the undefeated record means as much as it's promoted as, you know. But at the same time, I think that there is intrigue there because it's something that, you know, every single opponent that Floyd has faced in the last couple of years, there it's like, you know, there's been kind of like a backlash. Like when he fought Mosley, it was like, okay, well, then we want him to fight someone young. You know, and then he fights Guerrero, who is at least younger. And then it's like, no, we want him to fight somebody good. And as much as I'm not a huge Floyd fan, I think that this fight, you know, presents somebody who is either in their prime or just going into their prime or just before their prime, at the very least young, but seems to be getting better, bigger, stronger, et cetera. So there's intrigue there. And needless to say, I'd still be betting on Floyd myself.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, you brought up the point of the undefeated record, and you know, we always talk about how boxing cares too much about the undefeated record and promoters shouldn't put as much stock in that as they do. But the reality is that the fans do, and it's not necessarily their fault because there's less and less boxing on television, and that means there's fewer opportunities to make amends for a loss or to repair yourself in the public eye. So when guys take a loss on HBO, on Showtime, or ESPN, sometimes that's it for them because fans don't see boxing all that often, and it's not like there's going to be a comeback opportunity for them to make it up. I mean, it's just boxing isn't as well publicized either, so there's fewer opportunities to make that first impression or any impression at all on the boxing fan base and particularly on the general fan base. So if Canelo is a guy that hasn't lost before and people have only seen him win, that's perfect for something like this. I mean, especially for a mainstream fight, like on pay-per-view, that's just the way you have to go. And you do have to put stock in the undefeated record. That I think goes a long way to promoting Canelo, but it's also why it's funny that you'll see people take losses to the best fighters in the sport, guys that lose to Mayweather or Pacquiao, and that's it for them in the mainstream because that's when the majority of the general sports fans, that's when the most eyes are on the fight, and just seeing them lose at all automatically wipes out their stock. I mean, people now think that Ricky Hatton sucked because they saw him get knocked out by Manny Pacquiao. I mean, then that isn't reality, but that's when the most eyeballs were there. So, yeah, the undefeated record goes a long way when you're promoting these things before and after.
Yeah, and it also, even though, you know, we can look at it closely and kind of decide how much it really means or not, it's a good way to sell it to people who, like in this instance, you know, most American sports fans, they know Floyd Mayweather. Some of them aren't as familiar with Canelo Alvarez. So, you know, you get the question of like, oh, Floyd's fighting Canelo Alvarez. Like, is he any good? And, you know, you could say like, yeah, oh, yeah, he's a young fighter. But, you know, you say something like, yeah, he's 43-0. And then, like, that means something. That resonates to them. You know, and you get this reaction, wow, you know, 43 professional fights, undefeated? Sounds good.
Right.
You know, so things like that, it's like a real tangible thing you can use to sell the fight. And, you know, and but from my perspective, I mean, yeah, we know that some undefeated records mean more than others. And there's guys with losses who are great fighters and all that. But there is always, I think, some intrigue on this level of seeing two guys with an undefeated record. Because, you know, I mean, we've never seen Canelo lose. So either way, we're going to see something we've never seen before. And, you know, if Floyd I just think there's some – it doesn't have to always be that way, but there is kind of something, like, unique and special. I mean, two guys with over 40 fights and neither of them has ever lost. I mean, we know Canelo's case, most of those fights were just coming up as a prospect against not very good competition, and Floyd's obviously been doing it on a championship level for 15 years. But, you know, it is a good thing when
sure,
it works out.
And we know, I mean, obviously we know the difference between an inflated record, and we know what these records mean. And as you said, we know that it's not a big deal when a guy takes a loss or whatever. But it's a lot like selling a car or selling anything to people. I mean, you throw out specs of the car or the appliance or whatever, you know, fuel mileage or power seat belts, whatever it might be, or things more complicated than even I would know. And I would hear them and think that they're real fancy, and I would be intrigued. 43-0 sounds fancy to people. There's no question about that. They don't care that he was beating up whoever when he was 19 years old in Mexico. They just care that he hasn't lost yet. And like, as you said, the intrigue of the undefeated fighter is there even for the uneducated fans. Take a guy like Rigondeaux. When he fought Nonito Donaire, people didn't necessarily know that he was as good as he was. They knew he was undefeated. No, he hadn't stepped up before. But you get surprises sometimes, and when guys are undefeated, as you mentioned, there's things you haven't seen before. Canelo could come out of the woodwork and be the special fighter we all hoped he would be, and then we've never seen one way or the other, and we'll find out in September.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, you know, when you look at Robert Guerrero, Floyd's last opponent, you know, it's hard not to view Canelo favorably compared to Guerrero. He's just, you know, I think you could argue his win over Trout might be the best win that either of those two guys has ever had. And certainly at any weight class close to where, they're, you know, Floyd's fighting right now. So I think that's a good comparison, too, is like, yeah, he just dominated Guerrero, barely broke a sweat. But this guy's a lot better than Guerrero. I mean, at least we have every reason to believe that.
Exactly, and the only thing Floyd now has to do is convince people of that, because people were, A, didn't buy the Guerrero fight in the first place, and B, the people that did or went back and watched it after the fact, it was so uncompetitive that they really have to sell people on this one. I don't think they'll have too much difficulty, but that is one of the hurdles heading into this fight.
You know, and as far as, like you were saying with the odds, I mean, I agree with you. It's pretty eye-popping to see, wow, Floyd Mayweather is a 2.5-to-1 favorite, and that's it. You know, I mean, it seems such a cheap price to get Floyd, considering he's been 7-to-1 or 8-to-1 in most of his last few fights. But against Mosley, it was probably around 4-to-1 or something like that. But, you know, at the same time, those odds makers usually have a pretty good feel of how competitive a matchup is, maybe even better than a lot of boxing writers, you know, and sometimes these things can be telling. And I mean, I think if you look closely, I mean, I think there really is a good argument that Canelo is the biggest threat Floyd has fought since De La Hoya.
Here's the reality, and you just brought it up. These odds makers do this for a living. 80 or
exactly.
Probably 90-95% of people who cover the sport of boxing right now do not do this for a living. That is the difference.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there's
when
real
there's
money
big
to lose,
money on
isn't...
the line.
Yeah.
Yeah, when there's real money on the line, I think they're more apt to get guys who can analyze it in a realistic way than guys who were, I mean, not to put down any boxing writers or anything like that, but I mean, you know, there's nobody's holding a gun to their head when they're making picks. You know, we make that joke, you put a gun to my head, I'll pick so-and-so. Well, you know, the proverbial gun is to the head of odds makers and stuff like that. There are millions and millions of dollars on the line.
Right, yeah, and if they weren't correct the majority of the time, they wouldn't have a job.
Well, what I think is interesting here, too, is you would expect that with just most people wanting to see Floyd. I mean, I think there's a big segment that wants to see Floyd lose, and Canelo's a huge fan favorite. And you would think that, like, you know, I mean, this price is not enticing at all to take Canelo to win this fight. You know, I would think that there would be a lot of money coming in on Canelo just because people like to bet on who they root for. You know, most people aren't placing bets as, like, professional gamblers. So, I don't know. I mean, it's just the way the bookie's coming out with this price where it's, like, between 2 and 2.5, and you're only getting 2-1 to take Canelo. It's not appealing at all to take that side of the bet. And I would think that, like, that's where most of the money would be going before they announced the odds. But, like you said, I mean, here at these odds, unless you're a diehard Canelo fan, I mean, you're going to take Floyd if you're putting money on it.
Right. I'm going to be intrigued to see how the line moves as we get closer to the fight. Specifically on fight night is when I always like to look, because when with Floyd fights or, you know, Yankee games or really public teams and figures, Notre Dame games, the public likes to bet against teams and people like that. So money always floods in against Floyd, specifically on fight night. But where they have the line set, is it still going to come in on Canelo because you can't make that much of a payout from it? Or are people going to bet on Floyd in this instance? Or is this just the book's way of saving themselves from losing money on people betting on Floyd? Because I've noticed there has been a little bit of a movement on that in the past 2 or 3 fights. People just betting Floyd at whatever number comes out by the time fight time comes. And, you know, usually gets down to about minus 700 or whatever, but they know that they're going to win. So maybe this is the casino's way of preventing that.
Well, hey, Corey, I wanted to touch on Tony Thompson's win over David Price, but before we did that, since we didn't get to it before, we didn't talk about it, I just wanted to mention to anyone who's listening and is not familiar that Mr. Urban writes for Ring Magazine or Ring TV online, and you also work for Wealth TV and the Fight Network. And so since we were talking a couple minutes ago about there being kind of a lack of TV dates in general, which is definitely true, at the same time, I think that the online medium and also Wealth TV bringing more fights, even though the Wealth TV cards have been kind of few and far between, for the most part, they've been pretty solid that I've seen, and in my opinion, the Brian Valoria versus Hernan Marquez fight last year was probably the best top-to-bottom fight card of the year, for my money. So I guess I just wanted to kind of discuss how you got with Wealth TV, and, you know, I wanted to ask if, you know, hopefully in the future they're going to be doing more fight cards and getting more active with boxing.
Yeah, I mean, the Wealth TV thing just came about because they asked me to work for them. There's no grandiose story that comes with that. But, you know, Wealth TV has...
Good.
Yeah. Wealth TV has big aspirations when it comes to boxing. I mean, I was told when we had a meeting at the beginning of the year, or at late last year, so sometime after Pascal Kuziemski, which we also aired last December, I was told that the goal for this year was going to be 55 fight cards. Now, that's obviously not going to happen, and there are a bunch of reasons why. For one, putting on fight cards is friggin' expensive. You know, when you have to produce everything and do everything yourself, it's pretty tough, and it is not financially feasible for a subscription network to always be doing that. I mean, it's not even feasible for HBO to do 55 fight cards. So, you know, Wealth, you know, we have been kind of relying on promoters that already have a TV feed going somewhere, taking that international feed and then obviously sending our commentators, me or whoever, there and then doing the commentary over top of it. So that's we're kind of reliant upon international feeds at the moment, but if that gets more and more popular, that means more money going to WellTV, more money in their pockets so that they can take a card like, you know, Valoria and Valoria and Tyson Marquez, for example. If that didn't have TV, they could go and produce it and film it themselves. I hope that happens, and I've liked, obviously, what they've done with the amount of fights that they put on, especially last year. The fact that it's available to everyone online is a big deal. And the fact that they air entire cards sometimes. I mean, if it's going to be on and you're going to pay for the satellite feed for whatever an hour, just pay for the, you know, put an extra $700 on it and air every single fight. And it gives young fighters an opportunity to be on TV. And you know you're marketing to the biggest diehard fans if they're watching something on WellTV. So they're happy to watch the four-round undercards too. So I like the way they were going. I like the niche that we were kind of fitting into, and I hope it does ramp up a little bit more in the near future, both because I get paid for it and because I like to watch these fights as well.
Well, I mean, more boxing on TV, more TV dates, et cetera, I just don't really see how that's a bad thing at all for the most part. I mean, we've talked about this on recent shows that, you know, you don't need to show everything on TV necessarily, but at the same time, you know, if there are fights that are good matchups and they're probably going to produce, you know, entertaining bouts, then I'm all for putting those on TV. You know, that just having that expansion, you know, especially online, this is good. You know, boxing in some ways is kind of just starting to catch up with many other sports that have been doing this type of thing for a long time.
Well, I'll tell you this. Boxing is so far behind in terms of the promoters and their ideas when it comes to owning the rights to their footage. I mean, the cost of even purchasing, because remember, I work for the Fight Network as well, and I have a hand in purchasing programming that airs on our channel as well. I know what a card can cost, and promoters are just pricing themselves out, and instead of at the end of the line saying, okay, this isn't going to air anywhere, I better lower my price and just put it out there somewhere, they're happy with just retaining the rights to the footage and having it sit in the archives in their office. And that I think, is the wrong mentality. And it's the opposite mentality that the UFC has taken, that any other sport has taken, with taking any of the footage that isn't going to sell, isn't your premium stuff, and putting it out there by any means necessary. So if that means giving your card to WellTV or whatever to cheap, so be it. If that means uploading your fights after the fact, so be it. Because there is still a market, will always be a market for live programming. I don't think you're going to hurt your live TV ratings and vis-a-vis your advertisement too much if you put it out there a week or 2 weeks afterwards. I mean, there's so much boxing that is you can't access. It is inaccessible to anyone. I mean, the ESPN and Disney hold the rights to a century of boxing, and it'll never air anywhere. And then there's the last two decades are, for the most part, just sitting in archives in the offices of these promoters and aren't ever going to be aired anywhere. And that, to me, is a problem. I mean, Top Rank has taken a step in airing their undercards and archiving them on their website. I think that's a great idea, and it's an even better idea that they used the same program that the MLB has used and the same medium to air their fights, because it doesn't lag. It's not choppy like Epics or anything like that. It works. You can go and watch the old fights. They work too. Golden Boy started to do that when they had Fight Night Club as well, just airing it for free, and they were archiving those for a little bit. They've gotten away from that. But those are the things that boxing promoters should be doing. And they have to stop worrying about, you know, not getting $60,000 for, you know, their Thursday night card or whatever, and just putting it out there and letting people see these fighters, because that's what will make them money at the end of the day.
Yeah, I don't understand why.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was saying, it's always annoyed me that, like, you can't get classic fights on DVD in high quality. Now, I mean, almost every major fight is on YouTube, which is good, you know, because I think the UFC has some guy who just goes and pulls down everything immediately as soon as any UFC fight is happening. So at least the promoters aren't you know, aggressively trying to get rid of everything from online. But, you know, I've heard, I guess, that it's just a complicated rights issue, like an HBO broadcast. They have the rights to their commentators and all that stuff, and the promoter has the right to the fight footage or something like, you know, just too many people. But, I mean, wouldn't that be great to just have, like, you know, best of HBO boxing, a box set with, like, 10, 12 classic fights and with the original commentary and all that stuff? I mean, I think there's a market for that. I just can't imagine, like, it would be expensive to put that out.
No, I don't think it'd be expensive to put that out. It might be complicated as far as where the residuals go, you know, to the promoters and whatnot, or to the fighters, or whatever it may be, especially if it's a pay-per-view fight, and you might get payouts for pay-per-view buys. Contracts might be tricky when it comes to the HBO and Showtime stuff, but for everything else, for the stuff that isn't airing, I mean, just put it out there. It's literally just sitting there somewhere.
Well, you know,
and, you know, go ahead.
You see, when you go to those top rank cards, you know how they have that "This is Boxing" promo?
Yes.
And it's just this, like, HD quality footage of these awesome fights, like Pryor Arguello and Hagler Leonard, Hagler Hearns, and you'll never be able to watch it in that good of quality.
Yeah, they're just sitting in the ESPN offices. And I should say that some people have come forward. In Canada, they have done a really good job. Like, at Fight Network, we have the archives for all of Yvon Michel's fights that he's ever put on, and for all of Interbox's fights that he's ever put on. So we have everything, just the raw footage, or with French commentary, and we've put English commentary on it since. Basically, for anything that's ever happened in Canada, that exists. You know, we have that. Someone is making use of that now. And there's a small portion of classic fights that we just scooped up as well. A lot of the old Friday night fights and Wednesday night fights, like stuff like Basilio and DeMarco, Basilio DeMarco 2, for example, we have the master tapes for that. Those exist. But that is about like 0.5% of boxing history, or even less. The rest of it, as you mentioned, is locked up somewhere in perfect quality, and no one is ever going to see it unless ESPN Classics puts it out there, puts a whole bunch of pop-up videos, bubbles on it, chops it up, chops rounds out to fit it into a one-hour time window. That's the only way people are ever going to see these historic moments.
Yeah, well, and, you know, one thing I've always wondered is, like, I don't know if you guys have, like, HBO Go, but it's basically just, like, an online service where you can archive, like, pretty much, I think, every HBO drama series. But they have boxing matches going back, like, maybe 3 years. And so, I mean, I wonder, like, when is the time, you know, there's got to be some kind of, like, time, like, after a certain amount of time, the rights go back to the promoter or something like that. But maybe not. I don't know. I mean, HBO re-airs classic, like, Mayweather-Pacquiao fights leading up to the pay-per-views. So, I mean, I'm just all about the, like, DVD or something. Like, you know,
I know that I just own.
I mean, there's so many guys buying, like, illegal fight DVDs. And, I mean, if you could get good quality, like, high-quality fights, I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer. And UFC releases all of their old shows on DVD.
It doesn't make sense for me not to do that. I mean, it doesn't really make sense that they wouldn't do that, because it's basically just promoting their own promotional company for free. Well, not for free, but I mean, you know,
they could put them online,
and I don't know. It seems to me kind of ridiculous. I know that a lot of old fights, you know, there are collectors who have bought the rights to them, and then a lot of old fights basically are just sitting, you know, on, you know, what's it called, that highly flammable film, you know, in their collections and stuff like that, and whatever. To me, that doesn't really – it just seems like stuff that should be viewed to me. I mean,
yeah, the only, like, legitimate –
for a reason, and people would enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. The only legitimate boxing DVD I've seen is, like, this one. It's called, like, Best of Muhammad Ali, and it was produced by HBO Sports, and it has intros from Jim Lampley, and it has, like, the first Sonny Liston fight – the George Foreman fight, and then the Thrill in Manila.
Yeah, it's
so.
It's,
I mean, it can be done.
DVD. Yeah,
yeah.
It's just archaic thinking on behalf of the promoters, because you'd bring this idea to them, and they would say, "Well, a couple people will buy the DVD, and then they're just going to rip it online anyway." Well, for the fights, people are going to do that anyway. But for the fights that we're talking about, the ones that no one has seen before or would not otherwise ever see again. I mean, who cares? I mean, this is like people, it's hoarding. It's
well,
like
plus,
watching hoarders, and people are like, okay, well, if I save this, the value's going to go up, and I can sell it one day. Well, no, you won't. No one's ever going to buy this stuff, so you might as well make some money off of it now.
And they're already online. You know, almost every fight from the past like 20 years is already online.
Yes.
So you're not selling it to that audience. You know, you're selling it to like collect people who want to have like good quality collections. And I think it exists. Otherwise, you wouldn't have five websites selling, you know, bootleg copies of their old VHS tapes.
Absolutely.
I agree.
Anyway, well, I mean, should we talk about Tony 10-inch Thompson?
Yep. Well, Corey Erdman did agree to talk about adult video. We'll get to that later, but he did bring that.
Where does Tony Thompson rank on your pound for pound top five porn stars?
Well, I mean, who knows? I mean, remember, he's just dealing with a regular woman here who may not be used to 10 inches. So,
right.
You know, him injuring his wife. Actually, that doesn't make sense at all. He's been married a long time. I don't know what I'm saying. I don't know where he ranks.
He's past the aging Ron Jeremy at this point.
Yeah. Right. Right.
All right.
Oh man, I knew it was going to happen sooner or later. All right, well, fine. I'm going to ask you later on, so you're going to have to think about it. Your top three fighters that you would not want to see go into porn. But think on
okay.
that. We'll get to that later.
All right. Absolutely.
But Tony Thompson scored another stoppage win over David Price on Saturday afternoon here in the States. And in any event, it basically was not so much a repeat of the first fight, although it kind of was, and just in the sense that David Price got stopped again, and now he's kind of looking at, you know, having to rebound pretty hard in his career in order to get somewhere. You know, do you think that Tony Thompson really figures into that heavyweight discussion, or that he'll ever have a chance against a Klitschko?
No, I don't. I think he is exactly where he described himself in the post-fight interview. I mean, he kind of said it, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, I am that level basically right below the Klitschkos. And if you want to try and take a step up and beat me, you're not going to do it because I'm past that level already. And I think he basically put it as well as anyone could. He's the best American heavyweight of the past 5 years. Based on accomplishments and where he's sitting right now, until proven otherwise, he's probably the best American heavyweight right now. Would I pick other American heavyweights over Tony Thompson? Possibly. But if I'm making a ranking system or whatever, I still have to put him above that. No, I don't think he beats Vitaly. We already know he's not going to beat Vladimir. But there are other guys that maybe he could beat. I mean, say Povetkin upsets Vladimir, something crazy happens. Is Thompson utterly hopeless against Alexander Povetkin? Not necessarily. If either one of them retires and there's a vacant belt, he would get a crack at it. And could he beat any number of other heavyweights out there? Absolutely he could. So I think he figures in there. But we know he can't beat a Klitschko. But good on him for wanting to try again and make the million-dollar payday that's associated with it. I just don't think it's going to result. I don't think the result is going to change.
What do you think, James?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think he's going to be a great test for guys coming up. You know, and I'd love to see him, you know, maybe a couple fights from now fight a guy like Deontay Wilder or fight somebody like, you know, Bermain Stivern. I think that's, as he said, you know, that's the level where he's at. If you're beneath that level, he's going to beat you.
I should note that I do think that Tony is fading pretty fast, though. Like, I think looking at that fight, you know, just his physical condition, the way he was moving around, Tony is going to get stopped spectacularly before he has the opportunity to be that stepping stone that you're talking about. I think it ends in pretty startling fashion for him whenever he does lose, and that could be pretty soon.
Well, isn't he 40? Or maybe
he's 41,
like 41
yeah.
or something? I mean, so there's no way he's going to be hanging around that long. I mean, granted, they don't fight that often in general these days, and it's more like two, maybe three times a year. But still, you know, for a guy that's been, you know, taken out a couple times and is 41 years old, yeah, I don't really see him being a long-term, you know, stepping stone or, you know, test for younger guys.
No, but I mean, I think there's some interesting things going on with some of the young fighters in the division in the next year or two. You know, it seems like those would be better fights for him than fighting a Klitschko brother again. And who knows if the Klitschkos would want to do that. I mean, I don't know what Vitaly's doing. He doesn't have a fight announced, right?
No, he doesn't. I mean, well, at first we didn't know if he would retire or not.
Yeah.
I don't think that the Klitschkos are opposed to doing that fight again. I mean, I spoke to Jonathan Banks in Detroit right after the first Price-Thompson fight, and I asked him, okay, what's next for Vladimir now? And he told me plainly, we think we're fighting Tony Thompson again. So, I mean, that tells you that Vladimir isn't opposed to fighting him again, that they think the marketplace would buy that again in Europe, obviously. And so if they would do that with Vladimir, they would certainly do it with Vitaly. It's not out of the question whatsoever.
That's probably not a good idea. But like you said, a much bigger payday than anything he could get otherwise.
I don't really want to see him doing that little, like, sleepy time pose again that he did in both of the first two fights. It was like, you
yeah,
know,
he always, goes down with his arm as a pillow. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, it looked kind of comfortable as far as knockdowns go, but I don't really want to see that again. Well, I guess since we're on the subject of heavyweights, it was confirmed kind of overnight-ish if you're here in the States or here in the, on the western part of the world, I guess. But it was confirmed that David Haye is going to be fighting Tyson Fury later on this year. So, I mean, I don't really know that Tony Thompson fits into that discussion quite yet, because I guess it kind of depends on what happens in that fight. But how do you guys see that fight?
I'll let you start since it's your show. Go for it.
Okay. I see. I imagine that Haye's probably going to knock him out. I think he's just a better fighter from what I've seen. But I think it's a great matchup. I think it's going to be a really exciting build up. It's going to be a crazy atmosphere. And, you know, Fury's really going to have the chance to prove himself against a pretty big puncher. But the type of shot that Steve Cunningham landed on him, it's hard to imagine that he's going to get up from that if David Haye lands something like that. And Haye being much more agile and quicker, athletic, and having experience against, you know, better fighters, it's hard for me not to favor Haye pretty heavily here.
Yeah, I mean, Haye is going to be the betting favorite, and I think most people are going to pick Haye. But, I mean, let's all admit that Fury has exceeded our expectations by quite a bit. I mean, just with the wins that he's picked up and by beating Steve Cunningham, he has far exceeded what people were talking about, you know, 3 years ago when there were videos of him uppercutting himself. And, you know, people really thought he was going to lose. They thought he was going to lose every single fight leading up to this. So for him to even get to this point with David Haye is, you know, remarkable. There may not be a better self-promoter in the sport right now outside of Floyd Mayweather than Tyson Fury. The amount of buzz that he's generated for himself and with how smart he's been in the media, with the ridiculous interviews he's given, with everything he's done to garner attention for himself, there might not be anyone better in the sport, and that includes David Haye as well. Somehow, through beating Steve Cunningham, Tyson Fury has got a 50-50 contract with David Haye, and that's remarkable with what he's accomplished and where people thought he would wind up. He has talked his way into being, you know, even money when it comes to the contract with David Haye, and, you know, being around the Fury camp quite a bit over the past little while, the numbers on the table and what Tyson's going to take home for this fight, it's the kind of money that fighters who are fighting on American pay-per-view would drool over, and I don't think that people in the United States have a firm grasp of just how big this fight is going to be and, you know, how much money is floating around this particular fight.
Well, it almost reminds me a little bit of Antonio Tarver barking his way into the Roy Jones fight, because Roy Jones said for something like a year and a half, 2 years, that he didn't want to fight Antonio Tarver, blah, blah, blah. But then Antonio Tarver started, like, ambushing him at random press conferences and, you know, post-fight pressers and stuff like that, and just kind of rankled him enough for Roy to take the fight, which wound up being, you know, kind of his undoing in a way. That and going to heavyweight and coming back down, of course. But Phil. I mean, I agree that it's somewhat impressive that Tyson Fury has gone as far as he has with seemingly as little talent as he has seemed to have. I mean, he's improved as a fighter, there's no question, but, you know, I think I was looking at the line earlier, and David Haye opened up as like a 3 or 4 to 1 favorite over Tyson Fury already. So I'm not really entirely sure that this is the best move for Tyson Fury if he really is wanting to, you know, shoot to the top or take on a Klitschko, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think the fight with one of the Klitschkos wasn't really there for him. And it's also, you know, what we were talking about before, that once you take that big shot at the biggest names in the sport and people see you lose, you are not marketable ever again, really. I mean, in today's marketplace, it's so hard to rebound from a loss to a Mayweather, a Pacquiao, or a Klitschko. It's just almost not worth it. So if Fury is going to make $10 million from fighting David Haye, even if he loses, you might still be able to bounce back and fight a Klitschko and then get another payday. But if you were to fight a Klitschko, the David Haye fight isn't worth $10 million. So financially for Fury, it might have actually been the best move when you look at it. And, you know, from the perspective of the marketplace and the money that's on the table, prospectively for a Klitschko fight, which might have been, you know, let's say $2 million if he gets a mandatory spot or whatever, beside, you know, when you put that side by side with making 10 and then maybe still going on to make a million or two because Sam Peter did, this is the best financial move for Fury.
What, you know, I mean, I don't mean to suggest that I think that Tyson Fury is out of the fight. I think that his size in general, you know, makes it interesting. And then, of course, you know, David Haye has been fairly inactive. And in my opinion, his heavyweight resume is not super impressive. It's not crap either, but, you know, I'm just not fully convinced that David Haye is the, you know, kind of like top five or top three type of fighter that a lot of people, you know, put him in as. He's not a bad fighter for sure, but although I will say that, you know, when you look at Steve Cunningham knocking Tyson Fury down the way that he did, if you give David Haye that opportunity, I just can't really see it ending that well for him.
Yeah, I mean, Haye is obviously a much better finisher. He's a much better puncher. And Tyson Fury, for whatever reason, whether it's because of his skill level or whether it's because he riles people up so well in the pre-fight hype and whatnot, Fury just brings the best out of every fighter that he's in there with. And if he brings the best David Haye out of David Haye, then, yeah, I could see it ending where Fury hit the mat against Cunningham. It would end shortly after that.
Hey, Corey, I wanted to mention, I really liked your piece on Bermain Stivern going into that Areola fight. Where do you see him kind of fitting in the heavyweight division?
Well, we know he's going to fight Vitaly Klitschko. And, you know, I suppose if you want to choose one of the Klitschkos to fight, it would be Vitaly at this point. Because he has had plenty of injuries and his legs are slowing down and whatnot. I mean, Stivern is a guy that you could put in with anyone else in the heavyweight division, and it could make a fun fight. And you could also make a case for him beating anyone else in the heavyweight division. I think his fight against Ray Austin was a bad introduction to the audience for him because, you know, fighting the Rain Man is going to be kind of dreadful no matter what. Wasn't really the best style matchup for him. But against Areola, it showed that if you force him to throw his hands and you put a little bit of pressure on him, that he will. That he's athletic enough to throw more than the heavyweight average of punches in a round. And he has a lot of pop. I mean, this is a guy that was a pretty good football player in his time, and we've seen guys like this come up. But that means he's athletic. That means he has the stuff to create some fun fights. I don't know if he'll get it done against Vitaly. I don't even know when that fight is going to happen. I've heard that right now they're in talks to maybe bring it to Ottawa, up my way in Canada, among other arenas that they're in talks with. But we'll see what happens with that fight against Vitaly. Again, it's going to be hard to bounce back if he takes a drubbing against Klitschko. But if he does, there's lots of fun fights to make with Stiverne, and almost all of them winnable.
Do you think eventually there will be a new, like, legitimate heavyweight champion who actually beats Vladimir Klitschko, or do you think that those two guys end up leaving the sport and, you know, you just get a new guy coming up?
Yeah, I honestly don't see anyone on the scene who would be able to do that. I mean, you look up and down the rankings. I mean, is Bryant Jennings going to beat a Klitschko? No. It's hard for me, even though I like Stiverne. It's hard to pick Stiverne. Does he have the power to knock one of these guys out? Sure, but you have to touch him first. And then I think Hay showed what he would do against the Klitschko.
Right, but you know, I mean, if those two guys, if the Klitschko's retire, then all of a sudden all these guys who have lost to them are the next best fighters.
Right. So you're asking, do I think there's one guy who could beat everybody, like the rest of the heavyweights?
So, I mean, either then the heavyweight division is just terrible and you've got a bunch of, like, also-rans fighting to be the next heavyweight champion, you know, or somebody else emerges, I guess.
Yeah, I mean,
it's happened before.
Yeah, someone's eventually going to emerge. And I've said for quite some time that if you took the Klitschkos away from the division and the top heavyweights actually fought each other, that you could make all kinds of fun fights. The problem is that these heavyweights, and you just look at the top 10, you know, let's just go by whatever, the ring ratings, let's say, and you go up and down. You have Povetkin, Hayes, Pulev, Adamek, you know, Chagaev, Hellenius, who I don't think is very good at all, Fury, Thompson, and Stiverne. Those guys don't fight each other because the payday for all those guys is just getting a shot at the Klitschko and then riding off in the sunset or then repackaging themselves and trying again. If these folks actually fought each other, if they had any reason to, I think you could make all kinds of fun fights. I mean, you know, Fury and Stiverne is a fun fight. Adamek versus whoever is going to be fun. Hay and Povetkin is a fun fight. It's basically any combination of these guys, and then you throw in guys like Bryant Jennings and whoever else, Eddie Chambers. I guess Eddie's gone back to cruiserweight to fight the homophobic South African guy. But any of these guys matched up against one another, I think, is a fun fight. So will we get an undisputed champion out of that? Who knows, but we'll get a lot of fun fights, I would imagine.
Well, it's kind of I've asked actually about that on our show before about, you know, do we prefer to kind of have a vacuum of power in a you know, the absence of the Klitschkos, or do we prefer to have, you know, I guess, two-fisted dominance? And I don't really think anybody has come to a consensus yet. But personally, I mean, unless the Klitschkos are going to fight each other at this point, I think that they can pretty much just go away. I mean, it's not that I dislike either of them particularly. I don't really like Vitaly, but I kind of like Vladimir. But even so, if, like, this is what it's going to be, where, you know, Vitaly fights once a year and Vladimir fights two, maybe three times a year, and it's usually against guys that are kind of foregone conclusions, then I'd rather just kind of see the rest scrap it out.
Yeah, I think most people would agree with you outside of the European marketplace, who, you know, seem to adore watching either of these guys, and 55,000 of them will step in a stadium and tell you that. I agree with that, and it because they're at the top and they hold the balance of power. That's what I was talking about. No one, you just don't get any other heavyweight fights of note. I mean, the top guys aren't going to fight one another. So that to me, that's the biggest problem. It's not that no one can unseat the Klitschkos. I mean, if you had two boring heavyweight champions and then had awesome heavyweight fights happening every other week, it wouldn't be a problem. But because they are the only money makers really in the division, it prevents other good fights from happening between heavyweights that if they were to happen and they were marketed and put on TV, could eventually garner money for themselves and for other fighters. But there's a logjam up top, and so that's not going to happen.
Well,
go ahead, Patrick.
Nope, go ahead, dude.
I had nothing.
No, Jesus.
I was just going to go on my how heavyweights aren't as athletic as the lower divisions rants, but no need for that.
Well, okay, so
you know,
I'm going to switch gears, and
go ahead.
I'm going to ask about Miguel Cotto then. because it has been rumored that Miguel Cotto is going to be coming back. I've heard Delvin Rodriguez as a potential opponent, but regardless, I think that it's important because Miguel Cotto is probably the third or so best draw in the sport. But I've also seen adjectives like shot and done and stuff like that, you know, used when describing him recently. So my question is, how much do you guys think that Miguel Cotto has left?
Go ahead, Cor.
Okay, well, I mean, we know he can't beat Austin Trout. He wouldn't beat Canelo Alvarez. So I don't know how much he has left. I mean, yeah, is he good enough to be one of the five or six best fighters at 154? Sure. Could he go down to welterweight again and beat some welterweights? Sure he can, but I think that we know what his ceiling is, and that is depressing for his fan base and for people that have followed for him for so long, who were always hoping that he'd get that shot against a Mayweather or a Pacquiao, you know, always believing he was able to take that next step. And now that he hasn't, you know, there's the idea that you should just give up right away. And if he doesn't want to, I don't see any problem with it. I mean, yes, at least at the moment, you can suggest that he's taking TV spots away from younger fighters that maybe are more interesting at the moment. But at the same time, he provides a springboard for those fighters. I mean, maybe Delvin Rodriguez isn't the best example of that. This is kind of his comeback fight. But, you know, say he fights another younger guy at 154. He gives that guy the opportunity to be a tangible star and take a step up. He did it for Austin Trout. So he still serves a purpose. And I guess it sounds bad to call him a gatekeeper at the top of the sport, but that's kind of what he is. And there's lots of people out there who don't know as much as we do about the sport who just want to watch Miguel Cotto. And they don't necessarily – they'll say, okay, well, he lost his past two fights, so what? I still want to cheer on Miguel Cotto. I know who he is, and in my mind, he's still, you know, one of the only boxers that I recognize, so he must be one of the best in the world, so I'm going to tune in anyway. That's good just to get people's eyes on the sport of boxing anyway. And as I mentioned, if he can help create other stars by losing to them, that's good for the sport too. So I don't care if he comes back. Yeah, I'm going to watch, and yeah, I can absolutely see the positives in it.
Yeah, I think Cotto's an interesting case now because it's kind of like what I was saying earlier about the Friday night fights with Billy Dibb. I'm not really interested in that fight because I know Dibb's not going to be competitive against guys like Mahrez and Mikey Garcia. Now, I agree with Corey. I don't think that Cotto can be competitive against the best fighters in his division anymore. But there's a clear difference. Cotto is a compelling figure. He's had a track record. He's had a history that we've followed, and we've watched him in some great fights. And there's just something about him, his kind of like earnest workmanlike efforts, and the fact that he does have a lot of kind of special talents and has shown that, you know, at his best. He's just always going to be a figure that people want to watch, I think, until he's really really just getting the crap kicked out of him. And I don't think that's the case. You know, I mean, he obviously lost to Trout and lost to Mayweather. He acquitted himself pretty well in the Mayweather fight. Even against Trout, I think that as that fight's time's gone by, people have looked back on that as more of a kind of a domination than it really was. I mean, he had moments in that fight. He was holding his own. He had rounds that he won. He looked good, you know, in the middle rounds of that fight before Trout took over. So I think part of the problem with Cotto, too, is just like a very, like, visual thing that he really wears the time in the ring on his face. I mean, you can see kind of the ravages of the punishments that he's taken. He always gets really red early and has that kind of like swollen face that kind of looks like a beaten fighter. And I think that factors into it too, is he's a likable guy and we see him losing these fights and coming out of it like that, and kind of the depressing scenes after the Trout fight when Jim Gray asked if he was going to retire, things like that. You know, maybe it kind of tugs at some emotions that want to suggest, like, oh, well, Cotto should walk away. He can't win on the top level. He's just getting beat up in there. But, you know, I don't see it like that. I mean, I think that he can still beat some fighters. I think he's going to beat Delvin Rodriguez, who's not a bad fighter, and that could be, stylistically a pretty fun matchup. I actually kind of would have preferred to see a fight that I don't think would be as good in terms of, like, action or excitement, but I would have liked to see Carlos Molina get a shot just because I think he's really worked hard and kind of had a tough break in the Kirkland fight, and I thought he actually should have outpointed Arizlandi Lara in that fight that was a draw a couple years ago. So I would have liked to see somebody like him get a chance at Cotto because I just think that there's more at stake, and Molina has more to go for in the future. I mean, he's really a legitimate top five junior middleweight, right around that ballpark. So, this should just be kind of a fun tune-up and a nice little action fight. But I think Cotto, I don't think there's any reason for him to retire just based on the last two fights. He was competitive in stretches against the best fighter, pound for pound, in the world, and one of the best fighters at junior middleweight.
Well, one issue that I see with Cotto in particular is that he doesn't really seem that enthusiastic about continuing in boxing, and he hasn't for a couple of years. In just about every pre-fight build-up, in pretty much every fight in his last maybe 2 or 3 years, it's been mentioned to him, and people ask, well, after this fight, are you going to retire? Or, when are you going to retire? Blah, blah, blah. And he's just like, yeah, I can retire at any time. I don't really care about the sport or staying in the sport. So I think that, that might be, and I don't know how he's invested his money or how much money he has necessarily. I can imagine that he has a pretty decent stockpile because he doesn't really seem to be a huge partier or anything like that. But at the same time, to me, he just seems like he could kind of take or leave the sport.
Well, let's not forget he was spending his money buying Sex and the City DVDs and lotions for his maid that one time, and he did buy that transport truck to drive himself around for no reason. So he has some expenditures.
But did he buy any face lube?
Well, after seeing that commercial, I don't know. He does sleep with a dude, so maybe he saw Victor in them tight jeans with no underwear and might have been intrigued.
Hey, you said it, not me.
Well, I think Cotto's always had kind of a surly demeanor and just doesn't seem interested in, like, playing the games to try to put on, like, say the things that you're supposed to say in those moments, like building up to a fight. But that's kind of what makes him interesting.
Yeah, he's kind of an intriguing figure in his own right, in that in the ring he's pretty exciting, but outside of the ring he's kind of just he doesn't really show a ton of emotion, and I think that promoting a guy like that on anything but ethnic grounds could be tough to do. Well, all right, fine. Well, then we're at that point of the program where pop quiz hot shots.
Oh, whew.
Top three guys.
Sorry about that. I would have hopped in, take a drink.
Top three guys you would not like to see in porn from boxing. Go.
Okay. Number one, Zhang Zhao Zhang. I just think it would be really awkward. He's 4'11". It would just throw off my senses. He would be smaller than the girl. It would be really, really strange. And because he's from China, there would have to be censorship down below. And I don't get down with that. It's very distracting to the viewer. Zhang Zhao Zhang, he's out. In addition, I guess we'll throw any fighter from China in Japan in there. That's not me being racist. I just don't deal with the censorship down there. In Canada and the United States, I just don't want any blurring. Number two, for the similar reasons, but on the other end of the spectrum, I don't want to see Nikolai Valuev. He's too big. He's too hairy.
Good call.
It could be frightening. More frightening than whatever Tony Thompson is packing down there. And number three, I was always freaked out by Terrence Ali's smile as a kid. He was a real creepy, he's a real lighthearted guy, fun to watch in the ring, but it just is maniacal grin with no teeth always freaked me out. So I would not like to see Terrence Ali having sex with a woman.
Nice list.
Awesome.
That was solid.
Thank you, guys.
Foley, I know you've thought about it.
You know, this is tough. I'm going to have to go with Andre Ward first off, because I don't need to hear him complimenting himself the entire time. Then I'm going to have to stick Bernard Hopkins in there. I just don't think that would be a very pretty sight. Man, got to come up with a third.
You got it.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to say, like, pre-training camp Chavez Jr., you know, because who wants to watch that fat ass with his clothes off?
Well, I mean, to comment on those, for one, Andre Ward couldn't do porn because you know that sex out of wedlock, I mean, that's a sin. So he's not going to do that. He's the son of God. He knows that. That just can't happen. With Bernard, I agree with you. It would just be so boring. There'd be so much, you know, clinching and holding and romantic stuff and whatnot. Bernard just wouldn't know how to make it exciting for the camera. So even if he was pleasuring the woman, it wouldn't be enjoyable for the viewers.
Yeah, I think stylistically he would have some problems.
And as he's gotten older, you know, he'd make it slower. He'd still maybe get the job done, but not fun to watch.
How about Chris Areola?
At least he'd be enthusiastic about it. He'd try.
Yeah, he would have no problem with dirty talk.
All right, so then my three are going to be Sean Porter, because that would just be loud, and I don't really want that. And then Sugar Ray Leonard, because the first 2 minutes and 30 seconds would be, you know, pretty boring, but the last 30 seconds would just be, like, just horrible. And then...
he won that fight, 9-3. Clear as day.
Yeah, yeah. And then the last one I'm going to have to say, probably Carmen Basilio, just because he looked like a troll, even though he was a badass.
You know, I thought about Basilio, but I didn't want to disrespect someone who had passed away.
Fair enough.
That's true, but we should also point out that Basilio's eye in the Ray Robinson rematch would make a good porn starlet.
Perhaps. I should comment on, you know, if I could disagree on Leonard there for a second. I mean, for most porn viewers, they're just skipping to that final 30 seconds anyway. So if what he's doing is exciting for the final 30 seconds, he might be able to get away with a decent performance.
I don't know. I don't know that I would like his cornerman shouting, 30 seconds, Ray, you know, at the end there. I'm not really sure I'd be into that.
Well, the cameraman signals to you, or, you know, the fluffer or whoever it may be behind the camera, it tells you anyway. Boxing's a lot like porn.
The fluffer's the guy who gives that final thumbs up?
No. The fluffer is somewhere just hiding in the back, making sure that Ray is ready for that final 30-second surge.
Nice. I like it. I think those are some pretty solid lists, though, I gotta say.
Erdman nailed it, I don't know if it's just like a quick wit or the fact that he's a master of the porn industry. He had a jump on us from the get-go, but that was brilliant.
Yeah, it could be both.
The people were asking for, you know, adult video discussion all week, so we got to give it to them.
There you go, guys. You got what you wanted.
They should do the AVN Awards and the BWAA dinner in, like, the same ballroom.
Yeah, they should. They absolutely should. Would it make one or the other more fun? I don't know.
I have a feeling which one of those I would choose to be at. can I, Corey, do you have a couple more minutes? I had a couple of questions. Just one quick question.
Absolutely.
One or two quick ones. I wanted to ask you, like, how do you see your boy Adonis Stevenson having a long reign at light heavyweight?
His reign could honestly end at any time. I mean, it's awesome that he's having it, and it's awesome for Canadian boxing that we have a legitimate champion again. We haven't had a titleist in quite some time.
Jean Pascal.
I mean, that was the last one. Boutte before he lost to Carl Froch. What am I saying? But
I was talking like legit champ.
Legit champion, right. Yes. Pascal would be that guy. He could lose to DeForest Cloud. I mean, I hope he doesn't. Cloud has shown himself to have a pretty good chin at light heavyweight, at least from what we know. So maybe Stevenson isn't able to starch him. But, yeah, I mean, he could lose at any time. He had some scary moments against Donovan George. It could happen. But it's nice that Stevenson is going to get some TV dates. That gives guys like Elito Alvarez and other Canadian fighters chances to get on television that otherwise maybe they wouldn't, because HBO, for some reason, just doesn't want to come to, they don't want to come to Montreal, I guess, unless Stevens is there. I mean,
Lampley's been banned from all the strip clubs.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the reason, HBO doesn't get full rights to the fight when they come to Montreal, because Yvonne Michel retains the pay-per-view rights in Canada. So what happens is they actually get the fights cheap, but they don't get to air them in Canada. So HBO Canada doesn't get the boxing content. So it's tricky, and it actually discourages them in some way from coming here. But if you have the legitimate light heavyweight champion of the world fighting in Montreal, you don't have a choice but to go to Montreal. And they seem excited about him. They're talking about him. He's on, the fight game. He could lose to Cloud. He could lose any night, but I think it's going to be exciting whenever he wins or loses.
Well, it's kind of interesting. You have this, like, Canadian mega fight going on in the fall with Lucien Boutte and Jean Pascal in that division. So is that somebody that could potentially then move on to fight Stevenson for another huge fight in Canada?
Yeah, I think it would be more likely that Boutte would fight Stevenson than Pascal, because Pascal and Stevenson they're good friends and they're in the same stable. And I don't know that Yvonne would want to just cash out with one of their guys.
I forgot about Pascal high-fiving 50 Cent after the Dawson knockout.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they don't necessarily have to fight one another. Again, that they could, I could see it happening, but I see a lot of hurdles before that would happen. There are a lot of fights that I think Yvonne Michel would make before settling on Pascal and Stevenson. I think he would just kind of be crossing his fingers that they weren't the two left standing, so he wouldn't have to make that, but it could happen. And then I mentioned his name a second ago, Elito Alvarez. I nearly fought Nathan Cleverley for his title late last year. They only gave him 3 weeks notice, so he turned it down. But he's kind of knocking on the door of a light heavyweight title shot, one of them, at some point. So we're not far away from maybe having three Canadian light heavyweights in the same stable, potentially in the conversation for that title. It could get real interesting or real messy.
I don't know. I mean, if Alvarez was that good, though, why would he have hired that guy to poison Alan Green's Chinese food?
That's right. Yeah, why in the world would he do that, man? Why give Mr. Chow that kind of money?
Wait, can I ask both you guys, for both you guys, interesting thing about Stevenson, do you think that, you know, he is, yes, the legitimate light heavyweight champion, but he won that by knocking out a guy who had just been knocked out in his previous fight, obviously at a different weight class. Do you think that championship is cheapened at all by that anybody can say, okay, but Andre Ward beat the guy who was the previous champion, so...
Personally,
I mean, does Stevenson need to fight Ward to really get the credibility of the top, you know, top guy in that ballpark? Or can people always say, well, hey, the guy at super middleweight is better than anybody in that division?
No, I think that the fighter defines the belt or the title, you know, rather than the other way around. Because, you know, if for example, let's say Adonis Stevenson faces Tavoris Cloud and loses, then I think that will just say more about Adonis Stevenson rather than the championship. It will always move on, you know, especially if we're talking about lineal titles. You know, if you're the guy who beat the guy, then that's what it is. Although, yes, I do think that it was that Chad Dawson getting stopped in his previous fight did have something to do with it, most likely. But at the same time, you know, it wasn't in that division, and a lot of people attributed that stoppage to the weight that he had to lose, you know, going into that fight. So,
well,
you know, I don't necessarily think it's cheapened.
I was just thinking when, like, Ray Leonard had Donnie Lalonde come down, and I think they fought at 168, both the belts were on the line, the super middleweight and the light heavyweight. So some real old-timers who super middleweight's like a relatively newer division would just say, hey, it was a light heavyweight fight, catchweight, Ward's the champ in both divisions. And that could
have
been on the line.
I'm sure you can make that argument. I'm sure Nat Fleischer would make that argument, or you know.
I mean, I'm not like making that argument. I'm just saying that like it's just kind of unfortunate. And this was to me was part of the problem with Ward Dawson, that fight being at 168, is that if Dawson got brutalized, but yet he still is able to claim that title. It's a pretty thin title. I mean, and this is the whole problem with even, like, legitimate championships. I mean, there's still some that are seem more legitimate than others. And it's like, yeah, he beat the guy who beat the guy, whatever. But that championship was created from the Pascal Dawson fight. You know, it's not like some long-reigning distinguished title holder. It was just kind of a random occurrence in time where the number one and the number two fighter fought. You know, and then, of course, Hopkins beats the winner of that fight.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, Patrick, you're the historian here. I mean, there have been instances of guys just leaving their weight class with a title just to challenge for another one and then coming back, right? I mean, that has happened.
Oh, yeah, it's happened throughout history. And, you know, even back in, like, the 20s and 30s, guys like Tony Canzoneri, Henry Armstrong, these guys fought with multiple titles for multiple weight classes on the line. You know, I mean, there haven't been a ton of fighters who have won them. And at the time, even Leonard Lalonde was kind of considered a little bit of a farce. You know, when it happened, it wasn't like, oh, my God, Ray Leonard just won two, you know, weight. It was kind of like,
yeah,
it was a little bit of a circus. So, I mean, you know, I think that.
Well, anytime a fighter has a mullet, it's usually going to be a circus.
Well,
that's the Canadian hairstyle, guys. I'm sorry. And Donnie Lalonde is from my hometown of Kitchener, Ontario. So that was a sad moment for everyone.
Yeah, it's kind of a hockey/soccer hairstyle, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know what? Looking back, I mean, Sergio Martinez got his middleweight championship beating Pavlik, who had just lost to Hopkins at 170. So,
yeah, I mean, things like this happen all the time.
I guess what you do is what you do with it once you have it.
Exactly. Well, and actually that kind of brings up something kind of interesting towards something, Corey, if you do have time. Towards something that James wrote earlier today for Bad Left Hook, basically asserting that there wasn't much need for Gennady Golovkin versus Sergio Martinez.
Did you read that during the podcast?
No.
It just got posted like an hour ago.
You know, I speed read. What can I say?
Ah, okay.
But,
how I would prefer readers to read my stuff.
I skimmed through most of it, but I think I got the gist of what you were saying, and we'd talked about it on previous shows too.
I'm just kidding. I'm messing around.
Well, we don't do that on this show, so stop it.
My bad.
Good. Basically, James was just saying that there wasn't much need for Golovkin versus Sergio Martinez because Sergio Martinez has seemed to slip, you know, that much in recent fights, and that you know he's going to be out for about a year. You know, if he comes back in 2014, et cetera. So, I mean, Corey, would you agree that there's not much need for fights like that?
Yeah, well, I will say that there is a need for it to happen in that I think it has to happen in order for that transfer to take place and for people to, you know, really anoint Golovkin, because there are some people that still don't know about how eroded Sergio Martinez is. We've kind of referenced these people throughout the entire show, and there's always just the regular casual Joe fan who still thinks that Sergio Martinez is the best, and you still need to see him get beaten. And if Sergio wants to put himself in there and get beaten, great. I think everyone does agree that Golovkin would stop Sergio were they to fight. I think it'd be real tough to find someone who would pick someone, you know, you're relatively in the know to pick Sergio over Gennady Golovkin right now. I don't think you're going to find that person. I'm not one of those people. So yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying. I think it's totally fine right now to say that Golovkin is the best middleweight in the world. I don't see a problem with that. Does he have the legitimate title to go with it? No. But for that reason, it would be nice to see the fight happen. But I, without having read the article, I think what you're trying to say, James, is, yeah, he doesn't need the title for us to already say this guy is the best at 160. It's kind of unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of my point. I just feel like, I guess, that if it happens, I see it just being more of kind of like a you know, just a bloodletting,
like a formality,
ritual than any real kind of a competitive fight. And, I you know, the way Sergio fights, I just think I really could see him getting hurt badly in that fight. Because he's not the kind of guy who's going to just come in there and, like, dance around the ring for... You know, I was thinking about Roy Jones Jr., how after he got knocked out by Tarver and just really seemed to kind of... And then Glenn Johnson, and then just... It was just obvious. I mean, he was just physical skills completely eroded. He definitely fought, you know, much more carefully, like in the third fight against Tarver. I mean, he was just really content to just survive, dance around the ring, have a couple little moments here and there, and just make the 12 rounds. And he really didn't give a shit about winning or losing. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, he's protecting himself. You know, he had a great career, for sure. But Martinez, I do think, is kind of a different breed. I think he's got just a ton of, you know, confidence, maybe some would call it arrogance, but actually works for him in the ring. And I just think that if he goes into that fight, he's going to do everything he can to win, and he's going to go out on his shield to do it. And I think against a guy like Golovkin right now, considering the way he looked against Martin Murray, you know, I just think it could get really ugly.
I agree with that. I mean, you won't find people that'll. I mean, you may find people in the Bad Left Hook comment section that disagree, but
probably.
I don't think you'll find too many of them.
I mean, look, like they're you know, no one wants to see Martinez go in the ring against Golovkin and just dance around the ring and lose a 12-0 decision just to survive and hand him the title. No one wants to see that. But at the same time, you know, if it can't be competitive and be a real fight, do we want to see Golovkin just kick his ass? I mean, Martinez has a real, like, warrior spirit. That's one of the things not many people talk about. But in a lot of his fights, he's been down, he's been hurt, he's been in rough fights, and he's always come back. And you look at what he did in the 12th round against Chavez. And I know people have debated this, you know, well, did he go toe-to-toe because he just didn't have the legs to run? Did he not clinch because he was, you know, did he really have a choice to fight that way? And I would say, yeah, I mean, you do have a choice. You sit on your knee and you get TKO'd. And he didn't, you know, he didn't do that. He put himself in serious danger to survive that last 90 seconds to get to keep that championship, to take Chavez's little WBC belt and to remain the legitimate champion. I mean, he's got a ton of heart, and I think against Golovkin that's going to be a major problem for
and
him.
And I think the worst part about that, were it to happen, is we'd see Jim Lampley cry, and I don't want to see that anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if that gets him to remove the rims, then I don't know.
He's
got to
bring those turtle
it.
Shells back. I don't know what he was thinking, getting rid of the turtle shell. You know, he rocked that one time, and everyone just hammered him, and then he immediately changed to the solid black. I mean, you don't want to, like, let the crowd get you that rattled.
Well,
at least wear them two or three more times.
Maybe he got a two-for-one deal at LensCrafters. You never know. Maybe he just has two pairs, and he likes one better.
Yeah, it could be.
Well, what bothers me about it is that now that he's wearing the black rims, that I look uncool by association. I mean, I'm not down with that.
Dude,
no,
I'm all about replicating the Lampley look. I bought the black rims after I saw that.
It's funny because I, like, around the same time, I was in the market for a new pair of glasses. And, you know, given that I'm in a similar industry to Jim Lampley, when I saw him go on the air with those things, I couldn't buy them. And because then I look like a guy who's just trying to look like Jim Lampley. I can't do it anymore. And I happen to like the glasses.
Yeah, I think the thing that bothers me about fights like that is then everybody says, like, there's, you know, yeah, the knowing fans all look at it with a grain of salt, but there's still a contingent that then is like, Golovkin knocked out Sergio Martinez. And if it's not the best version of Sergio Martinez, it's meaningless to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. Unfortunately, it's a money-making fight, and Sergio deserves to get as much out of this kind of miraculous late career run as he can get. If he wants to do it, and, you know, that would be another one of those fights that would add to his pocketbook, but he deserves to stack up, you know, for what he's done late in his career. It wasn't easy and wasn't expected by anyone. So listen, if he wants to serve himself up and be the head on the stick, then he can absolutely do it.
Well, you know, being the kind of history-ish type of guy that I am, I prefer the formal passing of the torch to, you know, kind of a suggested one. But at the same time, you know, if that fight didn't happen, I wouldn't really cry. because to me, I think that at this point, at their respective points in their careers, I'm not going to call it a mismatch per se, and Sergio Martinez can still punch. But at the same time, it just, I mean, Golovkin is just a guy that looks, to me, he looks somewhat unstoppable because it's not just punching power. He's not winging like a caveman. He's got clear skill. You know, he uses his feet really well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so on. So if it didn't happen, I wouldn't cry. I just did want to point out real quick that we have about 5 minutes left. And so I was going to ask you, James, if you had anything else that you wanted to ask Mr. Erdman, get it in.
I'm curious for Mr. Erdman's take here on Yuriorkis Gamboa, actually. It's kind of a random topic here. But am I wrong, or you were a pretty big Gamboa guy, right?
I was not, but I will still answer the question nonetheless. Go ahead.
Oh, shit. I must have been prepping for – I think I was prepping for the Coppinger interview.
Oh, that could have been it.
Sorry. Well, yeah, I guess my question here is, because the guy's always kind of fascinated me the last couple of years. Do you think he's still got any chance of becoming an elite fighter?
No, I think we're pretty much past that point. I mean, we know that he's going to get floored by anyone who can punch a little bit, and we know his strengths and his weaknesses in the ring. And it seems that the bravado that was carrying him towards becoming an elite fighter and the fact that he was so confident and would take the kind of risks in the ring to throw those flashy combinations, that seems to be dying away. And not only that, but his opportunities are dwindling because he's with 50 Cent and because he's turned in back-to-back sleeper performances on HBO. His opportunities to even get that chance to face another elite fighter, they're also closing. So the opportunity is less and less likely to be there, and it's looking less and less likely that he would capitalize on it when that time came. He might wind up becoming, a guy like Joan Guzman, who looked to have all the talent in the world, and then for obviously different reasons than Joan Guzman, just never panned out the way that we thought he would. And because he doesn't have a great chin and seems a little bit spacey in the ring at times, that doesn't scream to me elite fighter. And it took us a while to figure that out with Gamboa, but I think we figured it out.
Well, I mean, do you think that – I think the only real, like, counter-argument to that would be, you know, even in the last couple of performances from Gamboa where he hasn't been spectacular, he's had, you know, large stretches of those fights where he was basically just toying with his opponents. And he still won the fights pretty handily as far as the points go. So – is it possible he's a guy who could just rise to the occasion? I mean, there's not many fighters out there for him to fight for a big fight. But, I mean, if he gets in there against an elite guy, do you think he's just destined to be knocked out? Or, I mean, certain fighters seem to fight to the level of competition. Could he be one of those?
He has the skill set that can compete with anybody. I mean, as far as pure physical ability, you have to put him up there with anyone in the sport. Now, he doesn't have great defense, but as far as offensive ability, he can light it up with anyone in the sport of boxing. So, sure, he absolutely could rise to the occasion. But if he's fighting down to his competition, it's tough to predict that he'll fight up to his competition. Like, if he isn't getting up for these smaller fights,
yeah,
he's getting rocked by Michael Ferreyrus.
All right, dude, hey, wait,
how
just
can
forget,
you go
and forget,
predict
hey, forget Midget Gamboa for a minute, because we've got 2 minutes left here.
Okay.
Real quick, Pacquiao Rios prediction.
I'm still taking Pacquiao. And I think he might stop Rios as well. I mean, I love Brandon Rios and everything. I just think he's going to take too many flush shots. Barring Pacquiao just not being able to take a punch at all anymore, I think that Pacquiao is too sharp, too accurate, and is just he's going to hit Rios too often for him to be able to win this fight.
Awesome.
I'd say it hinges on whether or not Pacquiao is going to be able to rebound. And if he is, he'll win. If not, and he's damaged, he'll lose.
I'm coming around to, I think, where you're at, Corey, that I'm starting to think that Pacquiao's going to blow him away. But, you know, there's a huge wild card there. I mean, we don't know exactly how he's going to react, because last time we saw him, he was, you know, good night.
And Brandon Rios is a monster.
He's a tough dude. I worry about how much punishment he's taking.
Listen, if Top Rank knows where they're going to make their money, and if they're willing to sacrifice Brandon Rios for this fight, I don't think they see him as a future money-making star. Like, as a business owner, Bob Arum, Todd DeBoeuf, the matchmakers there, I don't think they put Brandon Rios in this fight if they legitimately felt he could beat Pacquiao. And they are the guys who are the matchmakers, especially when promoting in-house, make their salary because they know who's going to win. I think they made this fight for a reason.
Well, we have about 20 seconds left, so I wanted to say, first of all, thank you so much, Corey Erdman, for
coming on
and joining us. Guys, check out Wealth TV, Fight Network, Ring Magazine, and also please visit Bad Left Hook, where James writes for and Queensbury Rules that I write for. Thanks a lot, guys. Take it easy.